This is the Faherty Podcast presented by Farmers Insurance.
So you all look splendid. Thank you for being here. My favourite sporting event in the world is the Ryder Cup. And for the last dozen years or so, tonight's guest has been the most important player in that competition. Love him or hate him, Ian Poulter has an innate ability to make sure that you don't overlook him. Whether you call it arrogance or confidence, swagger or style, Ian's a true original from the spikes of his hair to the spikes of his snakeskin golf shoes. And believe it or not, he's a fan favourite even over here. Except for that one week, of course, when he's a real pain in the ass. Ian, thank you so much for having us here at your home in Habersham. Now, tell me a little bit about this house. It's spectacular.
Thank you. You're more than welcome. Yeah, we've been here for 13 years, albeit that, you know, we live in Orlando now full time.
Yeah.
We use this house in the summer, and it really is home from home. The kids come in, you know, they know where everything is, they know where the bedrooms are. And, I mean, we love it. We love the garden. To have a place when the kids break up from school and to have that kind of 11-week window where you can get away from the Florida heat.
Yeah, it's a good decision.
Come and spend some good time. Friends and family are close.
Rock solid from Poulter.
Ian not only lives on two continents, he plays on two as well, having won a total of 13 times on the European and PGA Tours. He's been ranked as high as number 5 in the world, but his biggest mark has come in the Ryder Cup, where his passionate play has earned a stunning record of 12-4-2 and won him a legion of fans, as well as some detractors.
What do you think's most misunderstood about you, if there is?
I think people generally take me the wrong way. Not from my friends, not from my family, not from people that I've known for a long time. From the outside world, people that have only tuned in for a short period of time. People see me as quite arrogant. I'd say confident. People see me as extremely cocky. I would say it's confidence.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like some of the things I've said or posted or show on social media. And I know I've said a load of silly things through my time.
Well, not me.
So they have that opinion. And we all have opinions.
Yeah.
I wear my heart on my sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a player who speaks his mind openly.
His heart was firmly on his sleeve at this year's Houston Open, which he had to win in order to earn the final spot in the following week's Masters. A feat that seemed all the more unlikely after an uninspiring first day.
Played 17 holes, because there was a bit of a delay on the Thursday. Didn't quite finish that round. Was one over par. I'm lying 123rd, and I go to bed Thursday night, pack my suitcase, because at that position, I'm going to need to shoot a pretty low round of golf to make the cut, let alone get in position to win the tournament. So I was on the putting green, and I kind of opened my shoulders on Friday morning. I got one hole to play the 18th. Hold about a 30-footer. Well, that felt quite nice. And I hold a 25-footer. And I thought, I'm just going to roll with this slightly open shoulder position. Finish my round of golf with a 73, one over par. Went out half an hour later, shot 8 under.
Mm-hmm.
So from 123rd, obviously, I moved right up the leaderboard, put myself in a position, went and shot 7 under, and, you know, got myself in a position come what the back nine, where, you know, I needed to do a bit of work on the last hole to make the playoff. Turned into a bit of a gorilla there for a few seconds as the putt went in.
You did.
Yeah, I managed to be in a position where, you know, Bo made a mistake on the last, and I capitalised on that, got the victory, and got myself to Augusta.
Well, you've had bigger wins in your career than Houston, but where does that one rank?
I think it probably ranks the biggest of all of them.
You reckon?
Yeah, I think to have that six-year kind of drought from 2012, to do it in the way I did it, when I had to do it, to really force my way into the Masters, I'll put it there as number one.
How good a Ryder Cup player is Ian Poulter? His 72% winning percentage is the best of anyone who's played at least 15 matches. That's a list that includes names like Nicklaus, Palmer, Trevino, Faldo, Ballesteros, and Montgomery. He's been on five teams, four of them winners, and is undefeated in singles play. The Ryder Cup has been his focus for as long as he's been paid to swing a club.
When did the Ryder Cup first appear on your radar?
I remember I was working in the pro shop at Chesterfield Downs. So 1993, I'd been associated with the club for a couple of years. I was 17 at the time. I remember the other assistant pros in the shop decided to go to the Belfry for Ryder Cup. And I said, I'd love to join you. So I remember driving up there with the guys and we were trying to find somewhere to stay. We had a tent. So 3 miles down the road, there was this little campsite which was full. So we pleaded with the woman who owned the campsite, is there anywhere where we can pitch this tent? So she said, you can put it in my garden if you want. So just at the end of her garden, we set up the tent. We stayed in there for the whole week. We walked to the course every day. I remember it vividly. Faldo's hole in one, sneaking under the ropes when Seve was hitting his bunker shot. That was my first real up close and personal of what the Ryder Cup really meant, what it meant to Europe, what it meant, you know, to me from a boy who was, you know, aspiring to be a golf professional and the want to be inside the rope for the right reason.
Well, less than 10 years later, you almost made it in 2002. Did you feel like you'd missed your chance there, or were you confident that you were going to get there?
It was tough. I think when I, when I got the call from captain to say, sorry, but, you know, unfortunately, I can't pick you for the Ryder Cup, but I would like you to be first reserve, was a difficult phone call to take. I mean, as a youngster that's just got their tour card, as somebody that was close to making the team, but obviously not close enough, it was hard. I didn't take it very well, but it made me more determined to make that team in 2004.
There are probably too many of them to count, but were there any moments in the Ryder Cup that really stuck out for you?
Wow. There's been quite a few, I think. My first experience of my first match was against Tiger and Chris Riley, you know, 4 with Darren. So it's very hard to explain to people what the first tee really means, but the anticipation, the excitement, the adrenaline, the pressure, the nerves of just getting that ball on the tee peg is quite something. It looks like a pinhead as you're trying to place that ball on the tee. You can't think, you can't process information. Feels like it's all happening in a split second. And I remember Darren saying to me, you're going to tee off. I don't care where you're going to hit it, but I'll follow you down the middle of the fairway. So just smash it. Good advice. Unfortunately, we just got beat in that match. So my first real opener to a Ryder Cup was a loss, which I didn't like.
In 2008, you had an incredible match, you and Graham McDowell against Kenny Perry, I believe, and Jim Furyk.
Yes.
And even though, you know, the European side lost, that had to be an incredible experience for you.
It was an amazing week. Obviously, yeah, the loss was hard to take. You know, I remember Boo, you know, riding the driver. I remember having a bit of a shoulder barge incident on one of the tees with Anthony Kim.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
which was interesting.
Was that an accidental, deliberate thing, or?
It's a pretty big tee box. There was a lot of room to my right and to my left, but I guess he wanted to walk straight through me instead.
Right.
So, yeah, that was, you know, Michael Jordan was always there, every Ryder Cup.
What was like Michael Jordan doing there?
He loves the Ryder Cup and has been...
Motivational,
as he probably should be. He's quite a motivational guy.
Yes, he would be.
You know, that Ryder Cup, you know, for me personally, was being picked to play. You know, I had to deliver because there were a couple of names which didn't get picked to play, and I felt, you know, I really personally needed to deliver.
Is there extra pressure when you're picked like that?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, the match, I'll never forget the match against Perry and Furyk. Every hole on the back nine was birdie on top of birdie and, you know, 25-footer followed by a 20-footer. And it was just an insanely good match that was just right from the 10th tee. It really was hammer and tongs all the way to the last.
There's nothing like the Ryder Cup when it comes to making you feel special on the golf course.
For me, it's everything about golf. You could add up all of the Ryder Cups I've played to date, but you could add up all of the majors I've played. And one shot in the Ryder Cup, to me, is more pressure than all of those majors combined together. You know, everything about those 3 days, it's the best feeling in the world.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, some people are just destined to be professional golfers. They're born with a tee time and raised in a country club, and they break par before they even get their learner's permit. Now, that wasn't true for me, and it certainly wasn't true for Ian. We had to scrap and claw our way onto the tour and lie about our handicaps in order to turn pro, something that you just couldn't do today when a playing ability test is a prerequisite. We both would have failed that. And in my case, it would have cut short a promising career in broadcasting.
Ian grew up playing all sports in the working-class neighbourhood of Stevenage, about an hour north of London. He loved the team dynamics of soccer and basketball, but was most proficient in golf, even though it was far from certain that he was good enough to make a living at it.
Turn pro for 4 handicap.
You improved somewhat rapidly.
I didn't play golf from the age of 17 in a tournament until I was really 19. So there was a two-year window where I had to pay for green fees to play in a competition. Well, that didn't really work financially for me.
No.
So my handicap was off 4 at 17, and I kind of left it there until I turned pro.
Tell us the origins of your career at Leighton Buzzard.
I was working at Chesil Downs Golf Club. Shortly after that, I left there to move to Lee Scarborough. So I was 19 years old, and I stayed and worked for Lee for about 3.5, 4 years until I was 23. So I became PGA qualified, done my exams.
As a club professional?
As a club pro.
Yeah.
I've changed spikes, I've given lessons, I've re-merchandised the sharp, I passed my rules exams, my club repair, I did all that, great. You know, in that window, I was playing a lot of assistant pro golf, was doing nicely, and it was time to try and get my tour card.
The tour school?
Tour school.
Yeah.
Horrible. 8 days of hell. And it was only on my 3rd attempt where I was able to get through to second stage, which enabled me to have a challenge tour card for the 99 season.
Was there ever a time during those lean years at the beginning where you thought to yourself, bugger this, I need to do something else?
No. I had a lot of confidence back then in where I'd came from, the road I was on. I won every year I was on tour for the first 7 years. There definitely was a feeling of progression in all of those early years. I was loving it. You know, my dream job, play golf. In all of those early years, I never really had a little gremlin in the back of the head saying, what are you doing? You know, I kind of had to pinch myself on a regular basis of how the journey was unfolding.
Does that struggle to make it back then make you a better golfer today?
I think for me, as hard as it was back then, working the way I did to come up through golf, I have a level of passion which comes out in me when I'm performing really well.
Yes, we've noticed that.
At times. my love of the game has always been, you know, has been pretty strong. I think when I think back to the assistant days and mum buying me, you know, the folder of golf, which was an annual subscription, which every 2 weeks you got something new about golf, which that folder's still in the garage over there. I still kept it. You know, I love golf. I love what it meant to me as a failed footballer, someone who was rejected at football, and I didn't take rejection very well. So to become a golfer, someone that is in control of their own destiny, and no one can tell you otherwise.
Well, here we are at my favorite part of the show, Rapid Fire, where I ask you stupid questions and you give me equally stupid answers. Somebody start a clock somewhere. What's your favorite Premier League team?
Arsenal.
Which golfer did you look up to most when you were growing up?
Seve.
What's your favourite island? Oahu, Manhattan, Great Britain, or something different?
Great Britain.
Stop. Orlando Magic or Orlando City?
Orlando City.
Hmm. Beer or wine?
Beer.
Dining out or dinner at home?
Dining at home.
What food do you miss most when you're in the States?
Indian.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. Explain the origin of the acronym DBAC.
Unfortunately, I can't explain that on camera. Don't be a...
Right. How many watches do you own?
50.
50? What car would you love to add to your collection?
A 250 GTO, but it's never going to happen.
I know, it's never going to happen. You're a bit OCD. How organised are the clothes in your closet?
They're pretty colour coordinated.
Are they?
Hmm.
What current players on tour do you like to watch play?
Louis Oosthuizen.
Oh, I know.
Adam Scott. Tiger. Jordan. I mean, I could keep going
and
going.
Yeah, there's
quite a few.
Well, as always, you win nothing.
Thank you.
Somebody stop the clock.
Twitter, I mean, I just think it's fun. You know, there's over a million fans, and you know what? I can give them a little insight into what goes on a day-to-day basis.
You've got 2.5 million followers on Twitter. Is that a...
I've blocked about 4,852 people.
You have?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
The abusive, verbal abuse that has come on a regular basis. Yeah, I now have learnt to press block and not respond.
Right.
Where, take me back a few years, I would retaliate pretty aggressively. I've kind of learned to not retaliate in that situation. But I wear my heart on my sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a player who speaks his mind openly.
If you could take one tweet back, what would it be?
I don't know. I don't think there's one. I think there's quite a few. I think one of the nasty ones that happened was, you know, in Tampa when somebody was verbally abusing me while I was playing my shot on a par three. Luke, my son, was walking around. It was a few years ago, and this group of guys were really getting on me. They were abusing me on the way to the tee. They were abusing me on my downswing. They were abusing me when I hit my shot in the water, and then I had to play another one. And then the guy took great delight in tweeting a picture of him saying how fun it was that it was him who was getting in my head over those shots. It just so happened to be that he was a university college coach.
Oh, really?
So I retweeted his tweet and said, it's disappointing that, you know, you would do such a thing. And then obviously he was fired from his job. And from that, you know, from that moment was a moment of, you know, hatred from the general public because I'd cost someone his job. But it's okay for him to cost me money, which is my livelihood and my living that I'm trying to provide for my kids, and that seems okay. But, you know, I didn't intend to get the guy fired.
No.
I just intended to showcase the guy for who he was. I mean, he made a mistake. Should I have tweeted it? I don't know. But, you know, Luke, my son, was extremely upset because of the words and comments this guy was saying, because he could hear it. So, you know, I would take that one back. You know, having someone lose their job probably isn't great. Not that that was my intention.
More Faherty will continue after a few words from our sponsor.
Why is Farmer supporting my show? Well, I've interviewed over 100 guests, ranging from legendary golfers to presidents to celebrities. And just like Farmers is smarter from their unbelievable but true experiences, from each of my interviews, I've gained great knowledge that I can carry forward. Well, from most of them. Anyway, thank you, Farmers, for supporting my show.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
All right, then. Now back to the show. Like Seve before him, Ian has truly made his mark on the Ryder Cup, as you can hear in this moment from 2010.
Well, in 2010, Monty is the captain, so you're probably thinking you're not going to get a pick.
I needed to make that team.
Yes, you did. How hard did you work to make that team?
I worked really hard. And that team, I mean, if I look back now to see who missed out, Paul Casey, number 7 in the world, Justin Rose. weren't picked to play that year.
Hmm.
So I definitely wasn't going to get picked.
How did the Postman nickname begin?
The Postman really began at 2010, Celtic Manor. We've played all the Friday, Saturday rounds. And Tim Barter's on the range. And I remember the night before being paired against Matt Kuchar, knowing it was going to be a tough match. So I'm on the range hitting balls, and Tim says to me,
"You're at number five playing Matt Kuchar, who's unbeaten this week. Your thoughts on that match?"
I'm playing well. I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I live for the Ryder Cup. That's why I'm here. And I will deliver a point.
12 matches, that's very confident. You're absolutely convinced you're going to win.
I'll deliver a point.
Later on, I hear that Tiger hears that, sees it on TV, runs back in the locker room, says to Cooch, "Listen, Pulse has been a bit, you know, outspoken and says he's going to deliver his point. Suggest you go out and do the business."
And Poulter, what a performance. 7 under par for 14 holes.
Go out in my match, I play very well against Cooch and win that match 5-4. It was after then, back in the team room, that they started calling me the Postman, because I will deliver. So that was quite a funny tag to get from the boys.
Now to Medina. One of the most magical afternoons, I think, in Ryder Cup history. What are your memories of that?
I remember, obviously, Saturday's match. I think, for me, very pivotal in what was unfolding in front of us. We were 10-4 down. It was looking to be an absolute whitewash. My takeaway from that Saturday's match was dig deep. You know, let's not let this thing go. Let's have an opportunity and a chance to try and fight on Sunday. And I remember as that match was getting to around 12, 13, nothing had happened. The match was boring. It was probably one of the most boring matches I've probably ever played.
Then it wasn't.
And then it wasn't. and then it came alive. You know, Rory's putt at 13 on the par three to, you know, hold that putt from 20 feet. To start this little chain effect of what happened after then. I remember, again, Jordan sitting on the back of that tee box. He was in the gloating situation at the time, enjoying a 10-4 lead. We was losing our match at the time. The match in front was losing, and it looked ugly. But when that putt went in from Rory and I birdied the following par five to halve that hole, was really when I had the feeling that we had this little window of opportunity to try and get in 10-6. So we played the short par four. Zach had teed off first, hit it in the hazard. Duffner lays up. Me and Rory are both in that back left trap. I remember splashing my shot out to give me distance. I remember Duffner missing his putt. Matchell Square, 16th hole, big dog leg right to left. I hit it onto about 30 feet. I decide to roll this cheeky 30-footer left to right with a little bit of right to left at the end, which kind of drops in on the edge of the hole. And the eyes come out, the fists start pumping. I go bananas and I turn around and I'm trying to see where Jordan is.
You're looking for Michael Jordan?
Where is he? So I look up and I see him and he kind of shakes his head, and on my way to the 17th tee, I'm walking past Jordan. He kind of gives me a little respect jab, but his hands aren't very small. So this great big hand gives me a little jab in the chest, and, you know, I walk on to the 17th tee. We're one up. He's kind of energised now. You know, the match in front is going up the last. We're on 17. I hit this shot into about 10 feet behind the hole. Zach hits an incredible shot to about 4 feet below the hole. Mentally, you would give Zach that putt on a straight uphill putt. I remember talking to Latherbell, and as we're walking off the tee, he says, "Okay, the putt you've got, it moves a little bit right to left." So he says, "Just make sure you read it the same when you get down there." So I'm like, "Okay, thanks for that." So now I'm thinking the whole way down that 17th, oh, I'm thinking, was the ball in the exact same spot, Was it a little bit to the left or right? Is that putt going to break? So I'm thinking all of these things going through my head. I did start it just outside the hole, rolled it in. Zach holed his putt. I saw, obviously, Sergio and Luke managed to win their match, 10-5. It's on the board. And we're going up the last. Rory's shot comes up just short the front edge. I hit quite a nice shot to about 15 feet right behind the hole. This time, Duff hits a great shot to about 3 feet. So it's on Rory, and I'm thinking at the time, I've just made 4 birdies. Just hole this kind of this putt from just off the green so I don't have to hit my putt. I was kind of like, you know, praying that I didn't really have to hit it. Rory hits his shot. He leaves it a touch short. It's now over to the Americans because Zach was a bit further away. It was their opportunity to go first. They knock their putt in. It's down to me. And I remember the whole time as I'm walking around the putt, I'm looking at it. And as I get behind the hole, looking back towards where the grandstands were, I see the whole American team standing at the back of the green. To my right-hand side was the entire European team. And I kind of said to myself then, when you hole this putt...
When?
Go absolutely bananas. It was a sense of take control of that match, win the point, take it to 10-6, energise the team in a 4-point deficit, but it won't feel like a 4-point deficit.
You got a pretty special message from your captain, Jose Maria.
I remember getting the text. It was Christmas Eve, wishing me, Katie, and the kids a wonderful Christmas. And the text is still on my phone for a reason. He pays me a compliment. I don't think anyone will ever pay me that big a compliment ever again.
Compared you to Seve, right?
Yeah. And, you know, Seve was his teammate. And I can't, you know, yeah. I can't get a bigger respect than that text message. That's why it's still there.
Who is Andy Day and why has he been to Augusta so often?
How has this one come up? This is brilliant. Good old Andy Day. Okay. When I was going to tour school, I just lost one of my sponsors. So one of my great mates, Andy, I kind of chatting to him, how's things going? I said, not good, just lost my sponsor. What is it you need? I need some money to play golf. How much do you want? You know, Andy works hard for his money and it's not like he's got pots of money, but he gave me £1,500 back then. And I've never forgot that. He's still a good mate. And, you know, one of those mates that, you know, I put him down as a ticket every year. He wants to come. He loves it.
During his amazing rise from assistant pro to touring pro, one thing has remained constant for Ian, his wife, Katie.
When did you meet Katie?
I met Katie in a nightclub.
Yeah.
22 years ago. I knew pretty quickly that I wanted to marry her. So I asked her at the end of that year whether she would marry me.
Well, Katie's given you 4 kids, 2 boys, 2 girls. What's the best part of being a dad?
I think watching them grow into young adults, into, you know, sportsmen, sportswomen. The fun of being a parent to me is it's just new every day. Every day you come home, you know, even from the stages of seeing them crawling to walking, to playing golf, to reading, to writing, to driving. Cool. Amy's driving.
Right.
16. You know, we don't need to drive her to school anymore or go anywhere. She does it herself. You know, it's been an amazing journey and one that I view from afar, 6 months a year, but for the rest of it, you know, I truly love being a dad.
With all that you have on both sides of the Atlantic, the Ferraris, the whole lot, have you ever taken them back to the place that you were born, the house that you grew up in?
I did. A few years ago, I said to Luke and Amy, I said, I'd like to show you Stevenage, where I grew up. I'd like to show you my school, and I'd like to show you the house we grew up in. And at the time, my good friend Tom Hartley Jr. lent me a lovely Rolls Royce to drive for a couple of weeks. So off we went in a Rolls Royce down Canterbury Way to a terraced house, 405 Canterbury Way it was. And I pulled in the cul-de-sac where I pulled to the house, parked up in this lovely black Rolls Royce. And we got out of the car and I said to them, this is where, you know, grandma and granddad lived. This is where I lived. And this is part of my life for the last 20 years. So I stood outside the front of the house and showed them where I kept my bike and where my mum and dad parked their car in the garage.
Were you creeping around the house here and the people who live there now? I mean, were they wondering?
There was a lady in the kitchen and this woman was puzzled how, you know, these four people are standing outside the front of her house.
I imagine.
Pointing, and so she opened the window. And I said, I used to live in there for 19 years. So the words that came out of her mouth after that were, you wouldn't want to f***ing live in here now. Which I start laughing. I look at Katie. Katie looks at me. The kids are like, oh, my God. And then with the next breath, she said, would you like to come in? So I said, yeah, that would be lovely, actually, if we could. So lovely lady opens the front door. We go into the kitchen, which was not many paces through the front door. And the same lino floor was there from when I was there 18 years previous. It was very similar to how I remember, you know, leaving it all those years ago. And it was great. It was a fantastic day.
We've got to get to the cars.
We can get to the cars. It upsets a few people, though. The cars have upset many, many people.
Why would they be upset?
Because they think they're too in your face. I obviously post lots of pictures about them because it's my passion. I get a lot of abuse from people that take objection to me showing the cars.
Do you see them as toys or as an investment or both?
So I've always had this massive love affair with cars from a really early age. And I just had the want to be able one day to buy a Ferrari. To be able to go in a dealership and say I own a Ferrari, to me back then was everything. So I won the Italian Open once.
So did I. Thank you.
And it wasn't enough money to buy myself a Ferrari, I paid my caddy, paid my tax. So I promised myself the following year, if I win a tournament, I'd buy one. I won the Moroccan Open, which was one of the smaller events on the European Tour, which also that check wasn't quite enough to buy me a Ferrari. So the house come first, made sure we got set up with a nice house. Won the Italian Open again, and I thought it was an omen. So yeah. I went to the dealership and decided to buy myself a 360 Ferrari and kind of got the bug from then, to be honest.
Do you still have that car?
I don't have the car. I don't know where it is, don't know who's got it, or how many miles are on the clock. But that's my passion outside of golf.
Yeah.
But it's become a good investment at the same time.
Yeah.
And because of that, you know, I've tried to collect as many as I possibly can.
By my count, you've got 14 cars. You've got a gorgeous house in Florida, a beautiful house here, a museum for your cars in Florida. And yet you started off as a 4 handicapper giving £1 group lessons. Did you see this coming?
I mean, I don't think you could have ever seen it coming. You know, when I walk into the area where the cars are, you know, I still don't really believe I own them because it doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
It is remarkable when I, you know, sit down and kind of sit here in the garden, have a cup of tea, chatting to you. I mean, it's been an amazing journey.
Well, thank you for chatting to me, my good friend.
Thank you.
You don't have to like Ian Poulter to appreciate how well he's performed in the Crucible of the Ryder Cup. But I do hope you like him, because I do, very much. So many athletes have been pre-programmed to give the unoffensive, uninsightful, easy-to-digest answers that I truly appreciate the ones who are willing to speak their minds. Ian wears his heart on his sleeve, just like he wears the claret jug and Union Jack on his outstanding trousers. And while we may not always agree with what he says, you can be certain he's not holding back. Well, that's all for now. If you must, follow me at Fehertwit, Instagram, and wherever fine cheeses are sold. Good night, baby. Thanks for joining me, Fehertie fans. You can find more of the Fehertie podcast presented by Farmers Insurance on Fehertie.com and your favorite podcast provider. Go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher,
Art19 or Google Play. Search Fegarty and subscribe. If you love the show, and why wouldn't you? Be sure to leave a rating, review, and tell your friends.